I'm Annette Newell. Thanks for joining us. This week, Portland will have a special visitor. In this episode, I talked to Ned Blackhawk. He's a University of Washington graduate and a history professor at Yale University, who won this past year's National Book Award in Nonfiction, among other honors, for his latest book. It's titled The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples and the Unmaking of U.S. History. It offers perspective on questions about citizenship and the shaping of what America is today through the power, agency, and survival of indigenous peoples. Blackhawk includes the history of indigenous people in the Pacific Northwest, such as the oldest continuously operating Native American boarding school, which is in Salem, Oregon. Blackhawk will be visiting Reed College and also speaking for the Oregon Historical Society's Hatfield Lecture Series at the Arlene Schnitzer Auditorium during his visit to Portland. Here's my conversation with Professor and author Ned Blackhawk. We're really excited you're going to be coming to visit us soon.
I'm looking forward to being in Portland next week.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about how that all came about. How did you end up being one of the Hatfield Series speakers for the Oregon Historical Society?
It probably isn't too complicated, but they let me know early in their calendar that they wanted me to come talk out there, and I was very honored and excited, and so I worked my schedule so that I could take some time off from my teaching schedule to be there next week.
And they were really excited, too, when they heard that you won this National Book Award for your most recent
work. Correct, yeah. So I had accepted this invitation long before I'd gotten that and a few other fairly prominent prizes for my new book.
Yes. And what was that moment like for you to be recognized like that among other writers for your work?
It was really quite both kind of gratifying, but also overwhelming. I've had a few people ask me whether I knew about these types of things before I received some of these honors. And I generally say that I'm not that familiar with the kind of publishing world outside of my own scholarly areas. So my book is with a university press at the school that I work at, and I know the people there fairly well. And I never really anticipated like the foreign language editions and all the kind of notoriety that has come. But obviously, so that's overwhelming, but also very gratifying as well.
Yeah, congratulations are in order, definitely.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Let's talk for a moment, though, about the substance of the book, The Rediscovery of America, Native Peoples, and the Unmaking of U.S. History. Describe to me why that is the title and why is that so important, The Rediscovery of America?
The title refers to, as I indicate early on in the introduction, to the fact that there has been an incredible profusion of academic inquiry around these subjects for quite some time. For more than a generation, professional scholars and tribal members and others have been actively engaged in creating new paradigms and understandings about the history of North America. And so I suggest that we're living through this major period of rediscovery of American history, or that there is this rediscovery of American history that has unfolded. And so this book is an attempt to bring together the findings of many others. And so it's a work of interpretive synthesis. It's an overview. It's by no means comprehensive, but it's an attempt to say that we're at a kind of new moment in American historical inquiry where we can no longer uniformly unrecognize or underrecognize the centrality of Native Americans to U.S. history.
For so long, when we were in school, even I can remember when we were taught about American history, it was through the eyes of Christopher Columbus discovered America. And then you think about that, he discovered a place where there had already been people living here for thousands of years. So really, it does entail a major rewriting of the narratives that we've had for so long in our country.
And I'm really indebted to all those who've done the hard work to make visible some of these subjects. It's been really quite extraordinary to be part of this generation of scholars who has risen both professionally and intellectually into a space where these things historically have not operated. And so I am trying to generate broad attention to this field, or the attention to this broad field transformation. And so the Hatfield Lectures are a great place to have this conversation. I hope I'm engaging enough for a large audience there, but I think we'll have a fun time together.
Yeah. And you're going over five centuries of history in this book. So there's a ton of material in here. But I thought maybe we could touch upon especially some of the topics that you touched on in the West and the Pacific mm-hmm. Northwest, which is where much of our audience is. First, the Union victory recalibrated Native communities across the West. Describe that part of the book to me.
The Civil War forms in many ways the crucible of American history. And it is in many ways the moment at which what we consider a modern America emerges. Before the Civil War, the Union is incredibly divided. It's very weak, and it's dealing with very deep kind of constitutional failures that it's unable to resolve. These involve the continued expansion of human enslavement and related problems of state governance versus federal authority. And eventually, 7 and then 11 states of the Confederacy secede. They form their own country called the Confederate States of America. And those two countries go to war with one another. And the Union eventually reincorporates the South into a reconstructed American after 1865 and the Civil War's formal ending militarily. That period of Civil War transforms the capacity of the federal government in so many ways. And it's almost hard to underestimate those transformations or overestimate them. So the military grows nearly exponentially. The railroad connects the country for the first time. The government is able to tax and issue currency and essentially begin a monetary practice of federal governance that it never has beforehand. The federal government becomes a visible part in essentially people's lives, often for the first time. It grows in standing and numbers, and particularly in places like the South, where the Freedmen's Bureau and other government institutions are trying to reintegrate Southern society into the Union. This is happening out West, though, as well. And so I don't talk about the Pacific Northwest in great detail during the 1860s and 70s. I talk about it beforehand. I talk about it afterwards. So generally, though, in the West, the federal government is dramatically expanding its footprint in places and upon peoples. And so I focus largely upon the federal government's footprint upon American Indians, which include the kind of emergence of initially large-scale reservations across much of particularly interior Northwest and Northern Plains and Western Rocky Mountain regions. There's a series of monumental treaties that are signed in the aftermath of the Civil War that create vast domains of Indian territory in places like Montana, Utah, Arizona, North and South Dakota, interior state of Washington. And these large reservations then are created by treaties and ratified by the federal government Senate. And so they become the kind of administrative domain of a growing power of the federal government to regulate Western lands and peoples. And over time, Western ranchers and resource interests and eventually railroads will start cobbling away a lot of those land holdings. But for a while, the federal government is making a very large commitment to incorporating the West through this treaty process that has a lot of under-recognized legacies and components. And so in the Northwest, some of the big legacies, particularly north of Oregon, but to a lesser extent also in Oregon, are the fishing right guarantees that these treaties make. And so I think we're celebrating the 50th year of the Bolt decision this year in the state of Washington from 1974, a ruling by federal judge George Bolt, who upheld the treaty rights of Puget Sound Indian fishers to continue fishing at usual and accustomed places. That's a treaty right inscribed into one of their treaties from the 1850s with Governor Isaac Stevens in the territory. So that history is in many ways still with us or is ongoing, even though those large reservations became heavily targeted and often alienated because of these other interests that I was alluding to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know that there are, even today, there are so many of the rights are still being argued about, especially when it comes to water. There's almost a war over water going on in the West. And a lot of the Native communities in particular are really concerned about seeing their water poisoned by toxins.
Or they're left out of water resource agreements that mm-hmm. states are making. And so that was a big case last summer with the Navajo Nation that I was somewhat aware of and partly involved in. But for example, the boarding school system starts emerging across the West during this period. And so Oregon has one of the oldest run, continues to run Indian boarding schools at Chemawa that attracts Indians from not just Oregon, but across the Northwest and even Alaska. And so that's one of those institutional footprints that the federal government is building across Indian country and across really much of North America during this period. And there's a map in my book, I think of approximately 70 federally run or funded boarding schools across North America during this era.
And there were many in Canada as well. And there are many court cases involved with the mistreatment of children.
Canada's parliament established something known as the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2000, and I think five or seven, about to offer some kind of large scale overview of that subject. Mm-hmm. And they issued a recent final report that called this process one of cultural genocide, in which 150,000 Aboriginal children were forcibly removed from their parents and families and kept often in unsanitary and hostile conditions at often bleak institutional settings.
Yeah. And even today, do you think that the younger generation in these Native communities, are they getting enough exposure of this culture and the languages and the history that they need?
That may be a pretty broad question that I might leave to others, since I'm more of a historian than a contemporary analyst.
I thought you might have a strong opinion.
In some other setting, I'd be happy to have a slightly more informal conversation about that. But it's not something I'm as familiar with as others.
Let's talk a moment about this part of the book where you mention California Indians were targeted by federally funded militias and they were among the first casualties of the Civil War. And I did not know that. Can you go into detail about that a bit?
Sure. It's a little bit of a kind of provocative assertion, but it's grounded in fairly sound academic study. But the provocative assertion is to convey the extent and depth of the Civil War's transformations across the West, and to essentially unmake, as that's the theme of the book, some of the kind of conventional paradigms for thinking of American history more broadly. So the battle between the North and the South, which is at the heart of the study of American history, has largely excluded Western North America, almost entirely, to be honest. And so to say that California Indians are some of the first casualties of the Civil War is to take an intervention in that conversation, and to provoke these types of questions, like, how is that possible, or what are you talking about, or when did this happen? And so I can say, based on the studies of others, that throughout the 1860s, the federal government is starting to mobilize itself to fight the South in a kind of organized military way, following the South's secession and following initial shots fired by Confederate forces against Union forces at southern forts and other locations, and begins mobilizing its state populations and eventually starts enlisting state citizens in the Union Army. Before it does that, it starts sending subsidies to state legislatures to begin processes of troop recruitment and training and mobilizations and like fort constructions of various kind. And in California, which has already had a kind of ongoing set of state organized militias against Native Americans, particularly in Northern California and certain kind of Sierra Mountain homelands, these state militias essentially start getting federal funding to continue their wars against Indians. And so in the spring of 1861, before the Battle of Bull Run, in the summer of 1861, state militia forces in Northern California's Humboldt County are indiscriminately killing Indians, as they've been doing for 18 months or so, because Native peoples are poaching their cattle and making settlement hard. And so these state militias are now receiving federal funding. And I suggest then that they are actually the casualties of those campaigns are among the first casualties of the Civil War, because the Civil War is the kind of growing commitment of the federal government to use violence and military campaigns to enforce federal goals. And so now all of a sudden, the kind of state level violence is becoming a federal priority. And this is happening not just in California. I read about the Dakota War in Minnesota, the Sand Creek Massacre in Colorado, the Long Walk of the Navajos in the Southwest, the Bear River Massacre in Idaho and Utah, other campaigns in the Eastern California, a place called Owens Valley. There are a lot of wars, and I could have included more potentially in the Northwest, because there are also similar types of skirmishes and then larger campaigns forming. But these are the kind of more familiar studies of the West during the Civil War era.
When did the shift really happen where Native peoples were finally seen as U.S. citizens? Was that in the 1920s when that finally happened?
The final legislative commitment to make American Indians U.S. citizens does occur in 1924, and we're commemorating that 100-year anniversary this year. But the federal government had always, this is a complex subject, but the federal government had always held out the hope that eventually American Indians could become property-owning, English-speaking, Christianized, essentially assimilated American subjects. And that's why boarding schools and land alienation policies and other forms of the assimilation era were so violently imposed on Native peoples, because the federal government was trying to break up these differential sovereign and cultural communities and to impose an external vision of subjectivity upon them. And so that imposition included often this promise of some kind of citizenship. And so the problem with kind of our current understandings of American civil liberties, broadly speaking, is that we conflate citizenship with freedom and with liberty. And we think of those as kind of synonyms or interrelated subjects, which they are and have historically been for most American citizens. But for American Indians, to not be a member of one's tribal community, to not have access to one's homelands or to one's economies or to one's even family members, has been the kind of goal of the federal government in certain ways for a very long time. And citizenship alone is never going to be an adequate alternative to essentially the continuation of American Indian political and sovereign authority. And so tribal members are, in many ways, are much more concerned not about their civil liberties as granted by the federal government, but in ensuring that their tribes and their communities retain the kind of promised commitments that the federal government made through that treaty process and other things over time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and over time, I think we're seeing things like, for example, the election of Mary Peltola in Alaska as the first Alaska Native woman to be elected to Congress. That seemed like it's a huge milestone, but again, I'm thinking, why did it take that long? And the same thing with, you know, why did it take till the 1920s for the right to vote to be granted to our Native communities? It just seems like for a democracy, we've been dragging our feet.
Right. And we need to think of American democracy as something that is not at odds with this other understanding of American kind of political autonomy for Native peoples. And the federal government, its policy leaders, its executive offices and its Supreme Court justices have had a hard time coming to that realization. And they often are stuck with how do the constitutional rights for all Americans apply to these unique Americans, essentially. And Indians have to remind the federal government constantly that we are tribal members and U.S. citizens. And even though your laws are at odds with some of our own practices, we have a retained authority over ourselves and over our membership criteria and over our own lands and resources. And so it's a very complicated world, because what happens when non-Native people, for example, travel into those reservation spaces or marry into those families or try to obtain access to some of those resources? And then they complain that the federal government has a protection of their rights against these other tribes or other peoples, and those rights are in conflict. And so that happens very regularly in the American judicial system. And it's sometimes at odds with these kind of conventional notions of what constitutes American democracy and freedom.
Yeah, for sure. Now, I had thought you had some other ties to the Pacific Northwest. Did you go to school here, University of Washington?
Yes, I lived in Seattle for many years.
Oh, okay. So you're familiar with our neck of the woods anyway.
Yeah, and I spent some time in Portland, but not as much time in Oregon as I did Washington. Thank you for inviting me to do this.
Yeah. It's been really a pleasure talking to you about all of this, too. Okay, safe travels to you. Are you at Yale today?
Yeah, I have to teach and do some things this week. But very nice talking with you. Thank you for the invitation, and look forward to a successful week ahead. I'm also going to Reed College beforehand, so I have a busy
great
Tuesday.
Oh, wow. Okay, that'll be wonderful. I'm sure they'll be delighted to have you there.
Take care. Thank you, Annette.
That's award-winning author and professor Ned Blackhawk. You can get tickets for his Oregon Historical Society Hatfield Lecture, which is coming up Tuesday night in Portland. More information at ohs.org. Much of Willie Frank III's life has been about salmon and fishing on a river feeding the Cascades.
Running up and down this riverbank right here, you know, being a kid.
He's the Nisqually Tribe's chairman.
This is where I grew up. and just enjoying this beautiful playground that we have here.
His tribe is seeing fewer of the salmon they depend on.
We used to fish 7 months out of the year, and now we're down to 12 days. We're sitting here right on the Nisqually today with two of our nets in the water, and you don't see very many fish in there. Over the years, our chum salmon were our most precious resource, our Chinook salmon. You think about the time of the seasons, and for us, it was always Chinook season was money to go to the Puyallup Fair in September. And then you go to coho and chum, and that gets you through Thanksgiving. And then we used to have the best chum run in the South Sound, and that's what our Christmas was. And I think about where we are today. We haven't fished chum on the Nisqually River since 2015. We need more good people who are willing to listen to tribes, but also willing to partner and work to protect this area, the habitat zones, the watersheds, the ecosystems that we know are hurting right now. Mother Earth is hurting right now. We can literally see it. But then you come back down to this beautiful place here at Frank's Landing today, where it all comes full circle for me.
Kadi Bizieva is a fisheries director for a tribe.
We're anticipating, on average, less than 1,000 Chinook coming back up the Snoqualmie River. And when you try to conceive the journey that these fish have to go through, spawning and then making their way out of this river system, all the way out of the Puget Sound, up the coast, through Canada and Southeast Alaska, and then all the way back again, we should be doing more to ensure that journey is as easy on them as possible. Everything that they provide to us is intense. In seeing where we're at right now and the loss that we have witnessed just in the last couple of decades, it's obvious to me that time is running out and we don't have a lot of it left, and we ought to be doing more quicker.
Ron Garner is the president of a Washington State anglers group, also worried about salmon runs declining.
When you come in and start as a fisherman in the Puget Sound, it's somebody else's fault, always somebody else's fault. Nobody talks about the habitat being destroyed and things like that. The finger pointing's got to stop because it's not getting us anywhere. It's not fixing anything.
They're among a coalition of tribal members, recreational fishermen, lawyers, and experts called Salmon Warriors. Dr. John Starks, a Washington State University professor.
The coalition is extremely important. It's a really unique group of people in that in the past, some of these groups didn't really get along very well. And now they are all working together because we all see the problem of salmon decline and how it impacts the lives of so many. And so I think that this is a really great step forward. My hope is that we are going to reverse the decline in salmon, the salmon populations in our area, and in the whole Pacific Northwest.
And from efforts to save salmon to efforts to save people. This Sunday, March 31st, is Multnomah County's Trans Day of Visibility. This is an effort to prevent suicides and violence. Sharon Myron is a county commissioner, an emergency room doctor, and a mother. She explains why this effort is important.
We celebrate the lives of transgender people, calling out their basic human right to live authentically while still acknowledging that due to discrimination, the threat of real harm, not every trans person can or wants to be visible at this time. We have the opportunity to understand just a little bit more, to be able to reflect, to be inspired, to learn, to grow. Every action that we take, the proclamations that we do, when sometimes we think, what does a proclamation do? Why it is so important to be visible in a world that is so full of isolation, recognizing the intersectionality of all of our lives and what we do, and that the global is indeed the local and vice versa. In seeing the light and the beauty and so much of the spirit and energy and contributions of so many people here today and people in the trans community, we also have to acknowledge the harm, that need to constantly be combating discrimination, prejudice, marginalizations, violence, and murder against our transgender community. And the self-harm and suicide brought about by all of these actions by those who hate and bully and harm. From those challenges that are experienced here by people in our workforce, by people listening in, by the millions who aren't anywhere near us, we have to be fighting for secure housing, for access to health care, including gender-affirming care, safety in our education systems, and breaking through to end the heartbreaking rates of violence and suicide, especially experienced by transgender youth. We have to be doing all of this work. And when I think of the harm, I can't help but take a moment to pause and reflect on Next Benedict, how alone and harmed they felt. But seeing here and hoping that others recognize that they are not alone, their lives matter and are so important, and we need to do everything to support them. This is my last year on the board, so today's proclamation does take on special meaning for me, and I have to acknowledge I might freak out one of my kids that's here today. I have two non-binary kids. One is in the audience with their friend. I will try not to look specifically at them. One really wanted to be here, but is at school, is in college, learning, studying to be a teacher. Whenever I talk to them about teaching, they talk about what they are going to do to bring, expand understanding and intentionally focus on queer and gender inclusivity in the classrooms to make kids feel safe. I'm just so grateful to my kids for everything that they have taught me, for how they show up in the world. And as a parent, the most I've hoped for and continue to hope for is that they can live authentically and be safe. As a county commissioner, my job is to strive for a world where everyone's kids, people, can live authentically and be safe. That is the sacred role, really, that we have here on this commission. And I'm just grateful.
County Commissioner Jesse Beeson says trans people have always been among us, including those who contributed to Oregon history.
I was about 2 credits shy from being a history minor, so I always like to bring history into the room when I can, and recognize a former Oregonian, Dr. Alan Hart, who was born female presenting in 1890. Alan made his way to Oregon and graduated from my alma mater, Lewis and Clark College, in 1912. 5 years later, became the highest recognized, at that time, woman graduate of OHSU in 1917. Later that year, Alan convinced a doctor using eugenics arguments to get a hysterectomy, which I think only proves that trans folks have had to fight for the medical care that they deserve using all the tools in the toolbox. Then Alan began to live as a man and had the most amazing career as a doctor and radiologist and wrote 4 novels. I think that the visibility of trans folks is so incredibly important because it shows that the political project to erase trans people in this country and across the globe is relatively recent, because we have cultures that have for thousands of years recognized the important role that trans folks play in our culture, and the fact that they are welcome, that they are natural, and that they bring all their gifts to bear on society.
And you just heard members of the Multnomah County Commission as they voted to make March 31st Multnomah County's Transgender Day of Visibility.
I just want to appreciate all the work that you do to make trans lives more visible and matter in this community, and recognize that there is a cost and a burden to that, and appreciate that continued commitment to do what's necessary to move us forward.
You're listening to Speaking Freely with Annette Newell. Thanks for tuning in here on your favorite Alpha Media radio station. If you have a topic you would like to hear about on this show, please send me an email about it to annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. One more time, that's annette.newell@alphamediausa.com. Join us again next week. And check out our Speaking Freely podcast on KXL.com.